From South Dakota Public Radio, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment. This week we talked with authors Ruby Wilson and Phyllis Cole Dye about mindfully reading poetry, and we heard works from their anthology of mindfulness poems. South Dakota photography legend Bill Pay stopped by the studio to talk about his career in the state, and members of the band Back Alley played us a few jams. But first, Christine Albert and Chris Gage are well-respected, seasoned music business veterans with roots in the state of South Dakota, and the joy they experience making music together is fresh and infectious. They stopped by the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB Sioux Falls studio this week to share a bit of their music and the story of how they became Albert and Gage.
I went to college for a couple years in Minneapolis in 73 and 74 and just decided I'd rather play in a band and moved to Sioux Falls. My brother had a farm outside of Brandon called Weathertop Farm, and slowly everybody came together, and actually the guy that got us all together, Wally Sockerson, is landing at the airport as we speak, and he's going to be at the show tomorrow. So.
Wow. And we played night before last in Pierre, in his hometown, and our host for the house concert series, Ron Lutz, we figured out, booked Chris on his first gig 50 years ago.
Wow.
He was the judge at a talent contest, and he was like, oh, this guy's good. And he had a club at the time, so he asked Chris to play on the weekend.
The way he put it, he said, he came up to me and went, hey, little boy, put together a band. We're all going to make some money.
And was it like that sort of universal support from the beginning, or were people trying to talk you out of a career in music?
No, it was. I was always felt supported. You know, my parents kind of went, really? What? You know, yeah. But it's really all I've ever done. I flipped burgers for a couple of years in high school and have just done music ever since.
And how did you two meet?
Through music in Austin. I saw him play with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, who's a good friend of mine. He was in his band at the time. And he was kind of new to town, and I hadn't heard him, and I thought, wow, that guitar player's great. And then I forgot about him. a few months later, my guitar player wasn't available, and neither were any of the guys that I usually call, kind of have a deep bench in Austin, and people weren't available. So I literally picked up the Musicians Union directory to try and, like, who else am I not thinking of? And I got to G, and I saw Chris Gage, and I thought, oh, that's that guy that played with Jimmy Dale. He was good. So I called him to fill in, and he said no, he was booked. And then he called me the next day and said, actually, Jimmy Dale just told us he wants to cancel the next 3 months. So I could do 3 months, and then I'll be back on the road with Jimmy. And by the end of 3 months, he told Jimmy, I think I'm done. I'm going to go play with it. He was going through a lot of personal changes, and he didn't really want to be on the road for a while.
Yeah. The funny thing was, I was on tour with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and we were in a town car, just three of us, and we were chasing Natalie Merchant's bus. We were opening a bunch of shows for her across the South. And I said, Jimmy, I got this gig with a woman I don't know, Christine Albert. And he said, oh, watch out, you'll fall in love with her. And he was right.
Was that a huge step, though, or was it just feel like natural, like kind of move into that relationship that also was a musical collaboration? Because there's a risk there that, mm-hmm. you know, if you're doing both and the relationship is building, but yet there's a business side of things, too.
It was, because we both had, like, I had a solo career for many, right. many years, and so it was an adjustment in terms of creatively for us to sort of meet in the middle. You know, when you're choosing songs to record or to perform, you have to make sure they resonate with both people rather than just with one. And it was, but I felt so much joy. As soon as I started playing with Chris, it was like, I have never had so much fun making music with someone, and I couldn't imagine going backwards. Mm-hmm. And I had such confidence in musically and where we meet in the middle that the anxiety of performing sort of disappeared. It just became fun, and I didn't want to let that go. But I will say that we're doing a big purge in our house, and I was going through lots of stuff, and I found this postcard that a generic postcard somebody typed on a white postcard, and it said, lose the loud guitar player or lose a fan at that time. And it was like, that was the perfect manifestation of the risk that you're right. talking about, because I also had a following and people were like, what is this? But it, gradually, obviously, we've been together for,
and
you
her,
know, 23 years.
Her fans
years.
Were very protective of her
yeah,
and her
right.
career.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Interesting. And so I just said, well, sorry, you know.
This is the next part of who I am and what I'm going to do, yeah. which is something yeah. that every artist sort of has to go yeah. through, is say, this is how I'm evolving. I can't just stay the same because yeah. you love that particular
right.
Vision that you hold so dear to your heart.
Yeah, and since then we've both kind of gone off and done our own thing as well, so there's right. a nice balance now where we express ourselves individually and then come back together and right. perform and recording.
Let's get to some music. What will you play for us first today?
Well, this is one to wake us up.
All right.
And maybe some of your listeners. We had a good friend we just lost recently, and he liked to refer to morning as the crack of noon. So sometimes that's where I'm at. But even 11:15 is early for me. We wrote this. It's called In the Morning. I can hear the rooster crowing. It's messing with my snoring in the morning. But I don't want to get up in the morning. Get some coffee in my cup. I can hear the rooster crowing, makes me mad. I can hear my neighbor's Harley and his basset hound and Charlie in the morning. But I don't want to get up in the morning. Get some coffee in my cup. I can hear my neighbor's Harley, makes me mad. I was dreaming of the South of France. You were in a negligee. We were toasting with the fine champagne on a balcony overlooking Central Bay. But I can hear my wife working. Ain't no duties that she's shirking in the morning. But I don't want to get up in the morning. Get some coffee in my cup. I can hear my wife working. Makes me mad, so mad. Cappuccino in the morning, but I don't want to get up in the morning. Get some coffee in my cup. Got a headache from the vino, makes me mad. Maybe I should hit the snooze alarm. Sleep's the best thing for my head. Darling, you can make my dream come true if only you would get back in. Smell the bacon frying. Can't believe that I've been whining in the morning. Makes me want to get up in the morning. Get some coffee in my cup. I can smell the bacon frying. Makes me glad. Yeah, the morning sun shines, not so bad. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Moment in Sound from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery and SDPB Sioux Falls Studio. Albert and Gage are here with us ahead of the Sioux River Folk Festival and the Red Willow Band's 45th anniversary tour. They've got their own set that they're playing at the festival, solo projects, collaborations, and September 7th, a performance in conjunction with the Ken Burns Country Music Documentary in partnership with SDPB and the National Music Museum. What can yes. you tell us about that?
September 6th, actually.
September 6th.
In Pier. And they've got a guitar, a museum piece. I believe the guitar was an old Martin that was built for Merle Travis. And they've asked me to come in to Pier, my hometown, and play three or four songs on this guitar. I mean, you probably know more about it than I do. I guess it's in conjunction with the release of that documentary
right.
and special events.
So what's it like to pick up an instrument that has been played by so many? I mean, you've played with so many people, and is this like a no kind of, you know?
I just hope it's a good guitar.
Okay.
You know, famous guitars aren't always a good guitar, but
right.
But I'm sure it is. It's going to be quite the deal. I guess the curator travels with the instrument, and it's never to be out of his sight. And
right.
And so I'll only see it for a brief period. I guess I'll get to meet it at some point and play a little bit before the performance.
We talked about your collaboration a little bit, and let's talk about the collaborations that you have with so many other musicians. That's just an integral part of what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we do individually. We both kind of fell into that with, I have a regular Monday night show that my co-host has been Bill Kirchen, the guitar player from Commander Cody, for the last 3 years. Had another co-host before that, and Bill is transitioning out. But it's called Mystery Monday, and the concept is that we have this four-piece band, and then every week we have a different guest artist. So we end up collaborating with lots of Austin musicians, and some of whom I know well and some of whom I don't, because everybody in the band suggests people. So it's a wonderful way to just kind of spontaneously make music with people, and Austin loves it. And then Chris has a Monday night show that he's done for 24 years. So a lot of people come to my early show and then go to hear him. And his started to, at Don's Depot, started out as a solo piano, sitting at the grand piano, and then over the years, people wanted to hear him, so they'd come in and he'd have them sit in. So it continues at Don's, where there's these spontaneous, that's more spontaneous. He never knows who's going to show up. Mine is more organized, because I'm a Virgo. He's a Leo.
But Sioux Falls' own Boyd Bristow has been guests at our shows down there.
Yeah, and Tom Peterson, came to town, and it was really, and Kenny was the Mystery Monday guest a couple months ago when he came to record his album. And it's so fun to share our, you know, combine our South Dakota music friends with our Texas music friends. And they're always, you know, so impressed. Our friends in Texas go, wow, these guys are awesome. They're so much fun to play with.
Are you doing this because it's, you know, it's fun for you to do, and it must have that creative spark and that, you know, that mm-hmm. weekly, daily work of being an artist, but it's also creating something for these other musicians and really for the community to have that in place? I can't imagine. Talk a little bit how you've seen with both those weekly programs the ripple effects of that.
You know, it's funny. I sit at the kind of in the center of this big bar and on Monday nights. And I play for an hour by myself, maybe a little longer. And as I'm playing, I can see musicians come through the front door. And they give me a little heads up. Hey, I'm here. So by the time I'm ready to open up about 11 o'clock to special guests, I've got my pick of the room. And everybody knows I might call them and I might mm-hmm. not. And they're all very gracious about that. And I keep one of my old guitars there that they can just jump up and... Everybody gets two or three songs, and maybe four if you're an out-of-towner, you know. But I've had people come by from all over the world to sit in with me. And it sparks me, and it's helped develop my ear as a musician. I mean, mm-hmm. quite often I'm playing a song in front of 100 people that I've never heard before in my life. And mm-hmm. I listen for a little while, and then I go, all right, I kind of see where he's going, and... So it's good for both of us. They get exposure in Austin in front of my audience, and I get to learn from them.
Yeah. And the community aspect of it, you were totally right on, because it's not just the musicians and the community that creates, but for the audience. And that his particular gathering at Don's, we've played over the years, because we also play there as a band once a month, and we did a duo every week for about 5 years. But we have played at least three weddings that people that wanted to get married at Don's on a Monday night or a Saturday night, and several memorials. And the last one was just last month, a very good friend of ours, and he and his wife have been kind of the cornerstone best dancers in Austin, and just beautiful, gracious couple that everyone loves. And he was diagnosed with cancer and died very quickly after 2 months. So his memorial was there a month ago or so, and it was completely packed, and every musician in town and everybody that's an audience member that just loves Jim and Linda. And it was a beautiful thing. And there was a reporter there from the Statesman, our local paper, and realized, wow, this is a phenomenon. This is more than about one person. This is about this community that's gathered around this gig. So they did they ended up doing a 3-page story in the paper with all these color photos, and it was about Jim and how beloved he was, but also about the fact that this is what kind of evolves in Austin, that it's more than a performer-audience relationship. It's a community that builds around music, and it's the live music capital of the world. And it's true. It's unique in that way. The audience and the musicians are very intertwined in Austin. Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned Tom Peterson, who came to Austin, and he recorded an album with Chris, and a world-class songwriter from South Dakota who lives in Vermilion now. And we did an entire album of his music many years ago. So we're going to sing the title song, Dakota Lullaby. Seems appropriate on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Radio.
I called Tom when we were about to make that record, and I said, you know, we're going to do some press. We're going to let people know about this. And he says, oh, I don't know why you have to bring my name into it.
That sounds like something that he would say.
12 songs are all written by one guy that nobody had heard of.
They might be curious.
And this particular song has been around for a long time. I know Boyd sings it, and it's been covered by South Dakota artists before, and it's a beautiful song called Dakota Lullaby.
Spring, hear the last of the sad coyotes cry. Hear the ghosts of the plains sing of the buffalo again, and fall asleep to a Dakota lullaby. The ones who have returned to this holy land on which their fathers toiled. If you fall down on your knees, put your ear down to the earth, you might hear their spirit singing in the soil. That black crow calling as it comes home in the spring. Hear the last of the sad coyotes cry. Hear the ghosts of the plains sing of the buffalo again, and fall asleep to a Dakota lullaby. There's a million sleeping graves. They're gonna sing the songs that hold no trace of time. Hear that black crow calling as it comes home in the spring. Hear the last of the sad coyotes cry. The ghost of the plains sing of buffalo again, fall asleep to a Dakota lullaby, fall asleep to a Dakota
Thank you.
Exactly. What will you play for us next, please?
I think Chris is going to sing.
Do Black House Gold?
Yeah. We have a lot of South Dakota themed songs for you today.
The news shot through Denver, Chicago, and St. Louis. Up and down the East Coast to the heart of Dixie, too. And the story got bigger every time it got told. How the creeks and the rivers run yellow with Black Hills gold. They poured in by the hundreds to muddy Deadwood Town. Some panned the streams, others dug for it in the ground. 'Twas a few got lucky, most only got old. And their hair grew silver, looking for Black Hills gold. I've never met an angel in this wicked old world. The closest I'll get is a Deadwood dance hall girl. And I've never been to heaven, oh, but sure I've been told. All the harps and halos are made of Black Hills gold. Then the sharps and the hustlers come to follow their prey. The legion of soil doves to help them lead them astray. In the upstairs parlor, all pleasure is sold for a pinch of dust shining with Black Hills gold. Flop houses and card rooms filled with desperate men, and a few lost souls found their way to the opium den. Dream of valleys of poppies, the color of Black Hills gold. I've never met an angel in this wicked old world. Closest I'll get is a Deadwood dance hall girl. I've never been to heaven, oh, but sure I've been told. All the harps and halos I made of Black Hills gold. Climbed on a stump in a dry riverbed. He gave a sermon concerning revelation in a fiery end. Prayed for salvation for the sheep in his fold. Said, lead us not to temptation, just lead us to the Black Hills gold. I've never met an angel in this wicked old world. Closest I'll get is a Deadwood dance hall girl. And I've never been to heaven, oh, but sure I've been told. All the harps and halos are made
the Black Hills go. I've never been to heaven, oh, but sure I've been told all the harps and halos I made the Black Hills go.
Thank Albert you. Engaged.
I love that. Another Tom Peterson
Tom
song.
Peterson.
Albert engaged on a very special Moment in Sound, and it was Tom Peterson who came on the show and did a Moment in Sound and sort of slid your CD across the table at me and said, oh, you need to listen to this.
Oh, really?
So I'm so privileged finally I get to meet you in person.
Oh, good.
One more song before we let you go, and don't forget to come see them on Saturday at the Sioux River Folk Festival.
All right. Thank you so much. We've enjoyed this immensely. We're going to do a song by a Texas songwriter who passed away a couple years ago. It was a very close friend, Jimmy LaFave. He's an amazing vocalist and songwriter. But this always feels like a South Dakota song to me. It's called Buffalo, Return to the Plains. And his dad was from Gregory, South Dakota. So Jimmy loved South Dakota, and you can hear it in this song.
Lonesome travelers and rambling types shuffling down some unknown trail tonight. Hobo jungles and your boxcar dreams, living only by your ways and means.
Carry on.
A new light shines upon you once again.
Carry on and remain. Buffalo, return to the plain. Falling down.
The Brown Bag Book Club welcomes authors Ruby Wilson and Phyllis Cole Dye. The two authors edited an anthology of mindfulness poems, gathering the works of literary greats like Mary Oliver and Billy Collins, Wendell Berry, and Joy Harjo. We talk with them about how poetry fits into a mindfulness practice and how poems can be good medicine. I want to talk a little bit about, you could read this as a poetry anthology like you would read any other book. Page to page, dip in wherever you want to. How would you read these poems in a mindfulness way that would sort of integrate a mindfulness practice? Walk us through that.
Well, I think it depends on who you are because your approach will be different. For me, I like reading poems aloud because that's where poetry originally came from. And so when you read, to take every word seriously, give your full voice, bring your whole life to the reading of the poem, is the way some put it. And so you're investing all of your heart, mind, and body into every word of the poem. It doesn't matter whether you do that one poem a day or five poems a day, if you're dipping in and out or you're reading consecutively. That's what I would recommend, is trying to make it a full body experience. Another thing is that as you get familiar with the poems, you'll start to make connections among them. Mm-hmm. And that's another way of paying attention, is what does this poem have in common with that poem? And if you feel like a certain poem is turning you off, instead of saying, I don't like that, you know, be curious about what is the experience that you're having and inquire about what is it that's getting under your skin, and how can I enter into that without rejecting it? So you're practicing acceptance of the poet and the poem and the words even as you're reading them and experiencing them. You may not end up liking the poem, but you might have an appreciation for it if you don't just reject it out of hand. So that's another way of bringing
maybe
mindfulness
to it. Maybe it's the process of accepting yourself.
You might
learn something that surprises
that's
you
right.
as the poem sort of works its way into who you are.
Yes.
Will you read for us? I'm looking at really the first poem in the collection that you wrote.
Yes, this is on how to pick and eat poems, and it's outside the collection proper because I don't consider myself a poet, but it's meant to be a prelude poem or an introduction to the collection. So here we go. I'll try to put myself forward here. On how to pick and eat poems. Stop whatever it is you're doing. Come down from the attic. Grab a bucket or basket and head for light. That's where the best poems grow, and in the dappled dark. Go slow, watch out for thorns and bears. When you find a good bush, bow to it or take off your shoes. Pluck this poem, that poem, any poem. It should slip off the stem easy, just a little tickle. No need to sniff first, judge the color, test the firmness. You can only know it's ripe if you taste. So put a poem upon your lips. Chew its pulp. Let its juice spill over your tongue. Let your reading of it teach you what sort of creature you are and the nature of the ground you walk upon. Bring your whole life out loud to this one poem. Eating one poem can save you if you're hungry enough. Take companions poem picking when you can. Visit wild and lovely and forgotten places, broken and hidden and walled up spaces. Reach into brambles, stain your skin, mash words against your teeth. For love, and always leave some poems within easy reach for the next picker in kinship with the unknown. If ever you carry away more poems than you need, go on home to your kitchen and make good jam. Don't be in a rush, they're sure to keep. Some will even taste better with age, a rich batch of preserves. store up jars and jars of jam, plenty for friends, plenty for the long howling winter, plenty for strangers, plenty for all the bread in this broken world.
There is a certain amount of putting yourself out there to include a poem of yours.
Yes.
What was that moment like for you? Because I think that moment is instructive to the rest of us and really important for you to have done, because it's an invitation to others to do the same, to really create their own work.
I think part of being mindful is learning to let go of your ego. And my not wanting to define myself as a poet, or my wanting to put down my own work as an occasional poet, whatever, that's all coming from ego. That's coming from judgment of myself and all these sorts of things. But what poetry is at heart is sharing. It's connecting. And so to put yourself forward is really inviting someone to share the world with you on the page, and that's more important than who I am or who they are. It's our coming together that's important, and so that's the invitation of that poem.
Ruby, I'm hoping that you'll read something for us as well, and we might start with something that you wrote.
Okay.
Called Another Ocean, which is included in this anthology too.
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is a poem that really came after I'd read, I had been reading a collection by Mary Oliver. That was my reading part, you know. And it was A Thousand Mornings, and there were two poems in there, Tides, and the poet compares human nature to the ocean from which we came. And so I was reading these poems, I think, oh my, it sounds so lovely to be near the ocean, and I kind of wish I were near the ocean. And then I went out skiing, you know, I love to cross-country ski around my yard. I live in the country. And the words of the poem were working through, and I was encountering these things as I skied, and realizing that I come from the prairie, not from the ocean. Well, probably from the ocean originally, but anyway, I'll read the poem. It's Another Ocean, after Mary Oliver. I read her poems about the sea and wish that I lived near one, until I remember the wind that weaves soil, grass, and sky, the design of fox and pheasant tracks in the snow, and the owl I hear at night, who leaves fierce signs of its hunting nearby, and my silent ski trail that the wind erases through the prairie from which I came.
And, of course, I love Mary Oliver. Mm-hmm. And so many people do love Mary Oliver. And what is it about her, Ruby, that has just transcended, you know, overcome so many people's resistance of poetry? But she's also she died recently.
Yes, she did.
And was teaching us how to live in a way outside,
yes,
of a consumer crush of culture. I mean, there was so much more to what she was doing that was really instructive. Talk about Mary Oliver a little bit.
Well, I personally am really drawn to her work because she walks, she goes on walks, and she's, again, really paying attention and describing ordinary things that we might just pass by if we're not, again, being mindful. And that, and it's what I do, and so I'm really drawn to that. But why the appeal? I think it's the accessibility, and I think it's the experience that everyone is drawn to, and everyone has experienced, you know. We just may not express it as eloquently as Mary Oliver does, but she draws us in. We feel like we're walking with her on that journey. And of course, there's always in her poetry a deeper side. It's not just about describing what she's seeing, but how does that relate? How do those insects, how do those animals relate to each other, to her, to the world? I mean, and what do they have to tell us? What does the natural world have to tell us? I think that is probably the best gift that she gives, the best I can.
She wrestles with a lot of themes too, that are themes for all of us. And some of my favorite poems of hers are about dealing with grief, dealing with loss and trauma. And without kind of wallowing in trauma or something like that, she helps us find a way through it, and or is with us in it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of companioning by a poet or the bearing witness by a poet, I think, helps us feel understood, like we belong.
You've mentioned walking probably three
quite
times.
Quite a few times.
Quite a few times. And you know, there's a lot of outdoor themes. There's, I mean, you're outdoor people. You're,
yes,
you know,
we are.
Maybe all of us are in South Dakota to a certain extent, or we wouldn't live here. But you in particular, this is an important part of your life in the sense that also breaks down this idea that poetry, by some notion, is at a desk and... Mm. You know, or in the attic, you know, sort of yeah. an Emily Dickinson kind of theory of poetry. This is a very outdoor experience.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that, Phyllis,
well,
if you will.
Well, we didn't realize how outdoorsy the collection was until it was too late. But I think we're not going to apologize for that because that is who we are. And mindfulness can be a great teacher. Nature can be a great teacher of mindfulness. And so, you know, if you're taking mindfulness training, the same teachers who are having you dig into poetry are going to ask you to spend time in some way with nature, you know, because there's something about being in the outdoors that it humbles us, it helps us connect with our senses. If you go on a long hike, my experience is the person that I might be hiking with and I will be conversing a lot until suddenly we're not. And then it's just our feet moving and our minds still, you know. And there becomes this sense of the natural world as sanctuary. Now, it's not always like that, you know, but we find great sustenance there. And so, yes, there are a lot of tree poems.
Yes,
in
trees
here.
Especially.
Yeah. And it's like, well, go out and we're not going to say hug a tree because people don't like necessarily tree hugging, but that's what we're doing. You know, we're paying attention. And when those big trees, as they're coming down in Brookings now because of Dutch elm disease, and they're not there anymore, you recognize what they meant. It's just like a person being cut down in their life. You know, when they're not there.
A tree
anymore.
In South Dakota is a sacred thing.
It is a
it's
sacred thing.
It's not a given.
And it should be everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
So.
And I was always drawn, I think, since I was a child, to wooded places. And I mean, I grew up in, like I said, northern South Dakota, and there are not many trees. But it just, I think, you know, a wooded place, there's a sense of mystery and a sense of you can walk in there and have some sort of adventure. I just loved it. I like to build forts and go through paths. Whatever path yeah. draws me, it's the same way when I go walking. It's like, well, which way should I go? And it's just whichever seems to yeah. kind of call to me. So.
Let's read some more, some okay. other poems from the book. Phyllis, what would you like to select for people to listen to?
Well, this poem is really on my mind a lot these days, so I thought I would share this. This is a poem by Alberto Rios, who was the first poet laureate of Arizona. And has taught for a very long time at Arizona State University. He grew up in Arizona. He has a Chicano heritage. And he submitted this poem for our consideration, and it had to be in the collection. So this is called We Are of a Tribe. We plant seeds in the ground and dreams in the sky, hoping that someday the roots of one will meet the upstretched limbs of the other. It has not happened yet. We share the sky, all of us, the whole world. Together, we are a tribe of eyes that look upward, even as we stand on uncertain ground. The earth beneath us moves quiet and wild, its boundaries shifting, its muscles wavering. The dream of sky is indifferent to all this, impervious to borders, fences, reservations. The sky is our common home, the place we all live. There we are in the world together. The dream of sky requires no passport. Blue will not be fenced. Blue will not be a crime. Look up. Stay a while. Let your breathing slow. Know that you always have a home here.
One of the things I'm thinking of is people driving in their car and sort of having that driveway moment as you read that, not being able to get out of the car. And sometimes when I listen to somebody read poetry, I find myself falling asleep. And if that's your experience right now as a listener, that just means you're really, really tired. And it's okay, because I always use that as that when I'm in those moments where I'm listening and I just can't stay awake, I realize that that's the message, that it's time to catch up on your sleep. There's a lot more happening there. Mm-hmm. Ruby, what will you read for us from this collection?
I'll read a poem from a regional poet, Nancy Paddock, who is over in Minnesota. And I had first heard Nancy Paddock read at the Great Plains Writers Conference in Brookings. And it was before she had put any collections together. And I was so captivated, and I thought she needs to publish some of her work. But this poem that she submitted is called Lie Down. Lie down with your belly to the ground, like an old dog in the sun. Smell the greenness of the clover leaf. Feel the damp earth through your clothes. Let an ant wander the uncharted territory of your skin. Lie down with your belly to the ground. Melt into the earth's contours like a harmless snake. All else is mere bravado. Let your fists open into useless tendrils. Let your mind resolve itself in a tangle of grass. Lie down with your belly to the ground, flat out on ground level. Prostrate yourself before the soil you will someday enter. Stop doing, stop judging, fearing, trying. This is not dying, but the way to live in a world of change and gravity. Let go. Let your burdens drop. Let your grief charge bleed off into the ground. Lie down with your belly to the ground, and then rise up with the earth still in you.
Bill Pei got his start in the photography business as an errand boy for a Sioux Falls studio. After college, he opened up his own retail store at 30th and Minnesota. His vast photo collection includes both aerial and ground shots, landmark buildings, undeveloped land in the process of being developed, and more. Bill Pei is hosting a virtual tour of Sioux Falls on Wednesday, August 14th at the Siouxland Library's Cali Branch. We caught up with him to talk about the changing face of Sioux Falls. Let's talk about your career in photography.
Well, how I started was to begin there. I was about 15 years old going to Washington High School, looking for something to do to make some extra spending money, and got a job in a bakery frying donuts. And that lasted about 2 weeks, and I had enough of that. And a friend of mine said, hey, there's a guy down here that runs the Hanson studio that is looking for a errand boy, a flunky. And I knew something about photography. I had my own camera, and I knew the functions of it, so forth and so on. And so I went down and applied for the job, and he said, sure, we'll be glad to have you after school and all day Saturday, 9 till 9, $7 a week. So an hour and a half every day after school, and then 9 to 9 on Saturday. And I packaged pictures. The air base was running out here at that time during World War II and had an awful lot of pictures to do and ship all over the United States of the soldiers that were stationed out here. And my job was to package up the pictures and put them in the folders and take them to the post office and everything that nobody else wanted to do, everybody else didn't want to do. But then we used to go out on jobs to take pictures, and I'd bring all the equipment and so forth. over a period of 6 months or so, he's got some confidence in me and started letting me take the pictures. And I really thought I was pretty important, and I guess I was in demand because they pulled me out of class at Washington High School to go take some pictures because this Hanson studio had a contract with the Argus Leader, the local newspaper, to take their pictures because they did not have a photographer at that time because all of the men were in the service. When the Argus Leader needed a photographer, they'd call and I'd go get called out of school and go take the pictures. That was I thought I was pretty fancy, and my friends really thought I was great.
So Washington High School, for people who don't remember, would have been downtown at that time.
Right, where the pavilion is now.
Yeah, you're right in the center of things.
Yes.
You're 15 years old and you have a camera. What kind of camera do you have?
Well, at that time, it was a 35-millimeter camera, but the kind of camera I used when I was working for a Hanson studio was a speed graphic, which was generally accepted as the camera to have for commercial photography. All the news guys had them and everything else. So, and I got pretty good at taking pictures of that thing. It was a little cumbersome, and you hauled a lot of stuff around with that. But it was part of the game, and I wasn't 15 forever. I got a little going on, and after high school, I went to the University of South Dakota, and I took the pictures for their yearbook down there, and also on the weekends did moonlighting of my own pictures for people want to get married and so forth, family groups and so forth. And by then, World War II was over. The two sons of Emil Hanson that had the Hanson studio, Harold and Howard Hanson, had Harold's Photography, as you know it now. They were the founders. And I went to work with them, not taking pictures, but on the sales floor. But I still continued to take pictures on my own on spare time. Then after I continued doing that with them, I figured eventually that I knew enough about it, I should open my own store, which I did in 1953 out at about 30th and South Minnesota Avenue in the Southway Shopping Center, and continued on in commercial photography. Well, then a friend of mine was county coroner, and when he was elected coroner, he said, "You're my photographer," so I had 8 years taking pictures for the Minnehaha County Coroner, and that was really interesting. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, you're on call. Didn't make a difference if it was New Year's morning or 4th of July or when, or middle of the night or middle of the afternoon. Then I continued with that until about the 1970s, and then dissolved the camera store and the film processing and continued on in commercial photography, taking pictures, aerial pictures, ground pictures, wedding pictures, pictures of buildings, and which I accumulated quite a collection of. You aren't going to believe it, but I'm still doing occasional aerial photo.
Really?
But the drones have kind of cut into it a little bit. And I'm on call, I'll take pictures.
Right.
But the main thing is I like to show these old pictures, they're black and white, that I took in 1953 on up. I have them up until current. So a lot of things, pictures of a building before and 50 years later at the same site, and show how much has changed.
Yeah. Are you intentional about getting those? Is there a certain time where you say something has changed, it's time for a new photograph, or are you just taking them and as that process revealing a city?
The only time
motion?
I took a picture is somebody hired, somebody hired me. Another thing, I was kind of what you'd call a stringer for the United Press and International News Service. Right. If they needed some pictures taken out here, rather than send their photographer out from Chicago or Minneapolis, they'd call me and I'd take the pictures and box them up and send it to them. I never even saw the photos. They'd put the film undeveloped in a light, tight box and ship it out to them.
Okay, so everything from a wedding to an aerial photo where you only have a few seconds to take the shot to working for UPI as a stringer, you got to get that shot right. Talk a little bit about just accuracy and confidence.
I tell you, it's, experience is the whole solution.
Experience, okay.
Yeah. You get to know if you've got the right picture or not without fooling around taking a dozen pictures of the same thing. it's an act that you develop.
Do you develop that in the dark room?
Oh, I did all that kind of stuff.
But I mean, is that how you sort of learned that skill? Where you, because there's a big, people forget that there's this big gap between the time that you took the picture and when you actually get to see what you took, and that could be depending on how long you.
Well,
what is that process where you kind of learned and remembered what that moment was like where you took the shot, and then you see it in the dark room and you say that worked or that didn't work?
It's always a surprise. something mechanically could happen, you know, that you didn't know about with a camera, but not very often. Not, I mean, it's very seldom. Mm-hmm. But no, you generally knew what you were going to have, what you'd be looking for.
Yeah. Do you like the dark room? Was that a fun process for you, or was it tedious?
Everything was work.
Everything was work.
Yeah, but other than frying donuts, it's the only thing I did. So I don't know if it's work or existence.
Right. Good business, though.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. So many different, everything's different. I mean, no duplicates.
Right.
I mean, even if you took a picture of a building today and came back in a month from now, it'd be different. Trees are different, lights different, maybe the different owner of the building.
Yeah. How have you watched Sioux Falls change as a city? What are some of the things that stick out to you now at this point in your career?
Well, downtown Sioux Falls has changed so much. I can't believe what's going on. I have some sites of downtown, aerial pictures that I took in 1953, and exactly the same site again in 2003, 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one's color and one's black and white. That much changed right there. Yeah.
How much has the quality changed between that old black and white film and
digital?
Oh, boy,
I tell
now?
You, yeah. the quality of black and white was pretty decent.
Yeah, I miss that.
The film that I used was 4x5 inches square. It wasn't a small 35mm stuff. It was a large negative to start with. And I made for a local bank a couple of pictures for them that were 6x8 feet. And boy, they were just as sharp as if you had an 8x10 print of them.
Yeah.
So.
What kind of camera do you use today?
Well, I have a Mamiya. I'm still using film. I do not use. I haven't convinced myself to go to digital.
Yeah.
Besides, the biggest problem is finding film, but it's all right. And not a small negative, but what they call a medium format. So you get pretty decent, good, sharp pictures for the thing.
How do you take, now the work that you have done, do you think about the legacy of it and what will happen to those negatives and those prints when you're gone?
I already have that planned. They're going to the museum. Yeah. Here in Sioux Falls.
Here in Sioux Falls.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So better than if I expire and somebody looks at those, I don't know what these pictures are, that put them in the dumpster. Nobody's ever going to see the pictures again, see. So that's a good home for them.
Right.
Yeah.
When you look back at your career, what are some of, are there things you would have done differently?
Yeah, I'd have taken more pictures.
Folk lover, a classic rock aficionado, and an ex-metal bassist. At their musical core, they're a folk rock band. Of course, we're talking about Back Alley. Now, band member Ethan Pauly was unable to join us for this moment in sound, but that didn't stop us from sharing some laughs and enjoying some tunes. Here's one of our favorites.
Colors change on these built trees. My heart is set in the hills. My mind will ever bathe. It's not the same place. My mind is set on you. Problem, baby. or the thrills. Just come knocking when my sister's out. We won't have no explaining to do. I didn't make it to my show. Didn't bother me, oh no. Homer is a girl I never wanna miss. Yeah, see the bottom lines, I want you as my own. 3, 4, go!
The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at SDPBInTheMoment and Twitter at MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.